Here we go. Oh, yeah, we're recording. Okay, so hi there. My name's Alex Bingley, and I am interviewing Nadia Kavan. So I will just give you a little bit of an introduction to Nadia before we start our discussion. So Nadia is an English dancer, dance teacher, choreographer, movement teacher, and teacher of the Alexander Technique. She lives in Nijmegen. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
Nijmegen.
I'm not at all. Nijmegen, in the Netherlands, and has been teaching at Folkwang University of the Arts in Essen since 1993. Nadia studied classical ballet, modern dance, dance pedagogy, and voice training, which I was interested to see when I read it. We can talk about that in England. And from 1973, she was in Germany, where she danced for various companies and also worked as a freelance dancer and dance teacher in Hamburg. In 1981, she came into contact with the Alexander Technique in London and then graduated as an Alexander teacher in Denmark, trained by Karen Wentworth and Chris Stevens. She also received training from Walter Carrington, who any of our listeners will know was mentioned in a previous podcast about the Alexander Technique. She has been teaching the technique herself since 1987. Since 1998, Nadia worked with the director. Now, again, you'll have to help me here. Frank Steckel.
Steckel.
At many German theatres. In 2000, she founded the Open Space Theatre as a training centre for the Alexander Technique in Cologne. Since 2005, Nadia worked with the singer and singing teacher and Alexander teacher, Ron Murdoch. And then with Ron went to develop and open the Awareness Center training course. Nadia has continued to be involved in dance and theater projects, both at Folkwang and professionally elsewhere, and has also developed her own personal practice called Dance of Life. So is this, I just took this straight off Wikipedia, so is that correct? Is there any changes or additions?
It's absolutely fine. Thank you.
So that's an impressive biography, and what's very interesting reading it is how there's been this very big parallel running through your life as a dancer and an artist. And as a teacher of the technique, and as a teacher of movement, and a teacher of dance, and a choreographer and movement director. And I just wondered, first of all, sort of how you got into dance. Maybe that would be a useful place to start. And then how you moved from there into discovering the Alexander Technique.
I got into dance because as a child, I could never sit still. And also, I think as a child, I had an imagination that needed some kind of expression. I was always very interested in all the arts. I was very interested in acting, and I was very interested in fine arts and visual arts and sculpture. When it came round to choosing, my sister had already gone to art school to study at Central Art School. She was undoubtedly the more talented actress between us. She got a lot of, when she was in school productions, she got quite a lot of public attention. But my dear parents were concerned that their sensitive daughter would go under if she studied acting. So my sister used her other talents and decided to go to Central School of Art. Now, I was the younger daughter, and I was running around freely and winning sort of talent competitions here and there. And I thought, well, if my sister hadn't been allowed to study acting and she'd gone to art school, then probably the best thing for me is to do the other one, and that is to become a dancer. But I was actually quite a clever kid because I said to my mother, I want to be a dance teacher. So they thought, what a sensible daughter. She seems wild and uncontrollable, but she's suddenly become terribly sensible. So I was allowed to go to ballet school and to become a dance teacher. And of course, I continued and did all my art exams and became a professional dancer, both in classical and modern. So that's how I ended up doing it.
So, do you mind telling us how, what ballet school you went to, and maybe sort of roughly what year this was, if you don't mind?
I studied between, I was 16 when I started. So, I studied when I was in 1971, and I went to a private school in Surrey. I grew up in Surrey, and we did the Royal Academy method and the Imperial method for ballet exams. And then for my modern exams, I also did the Imperial method. And for my voice diploma, I did the Imperial method. We were trained as dancers, actors, singers. So I did those qualifications, and then as soon as I was qualified in 74, I left for a opera ballet company in the south of Germany.
So just the voice teacher, with my voice teacher hat on, just out of curiosity, do you remember what you were taught in your voice training sort of back then?
Extremely little what I was taught in my voice training. I was sent to elocution when I was 4 years old because as a very highly excitable child, nobody could understand what I was talking about. And I was always so excited about everything that happened in the day, and I spoke so fast and apparently nobody understood a word. So my mother sent me to elocution where my sister already was. And I actually quite enjoyed it. And I do remember standing on a very big stage somewhere in London and taking my, some exams, elocution exams for kids. I'm not quite sure what it was. But right. I had to learn these poems off by heart. And I stood on this huge stage. And I actually quite enjoyed doing that. I enjoyed poetry as a child very, very much. I was dyslexic. And so I had a lot of reading difficulties, but poems I could manage, it certainly gave me a feel of the magic of the spoken word. And then suddenly my family started to understand me, so I thought, okay, it must be working some way. And then I did a voice pedagogue or a pedagogic diploma then through the Imperial Society, but I don't really remember much about it. I remember enjoying it tremendously, and I remember that when I taught afterwards that everybody said I had a good voice and that people always would understand me and I had a very expressive voice. So I'm sure my teacher did plenty of good things. Ron, my late husband, whose voice work I just admired above anybody else in the whole world, he always said that my diaphragm was frighteningly tense. So he said that I was taught in the sort of old-fashioned British way and that I would use my diaphragm. So it took me a few years in the good hands of Ronald Murdoch to learn to breathe out. There you go.
Yeah. It's interesting.
So that's my story.
I mean, in other podcasts we were talking about that my teacher was David Carey was talking a little bit about the history of voice teaching and voice teachers when they were initially trained at Central sort of early on. Most of them went to work in educational institutions. And most of the elocution teachers you would have found, or most of the voice teachers in any educational institution, be it schools or private schools, probably would have either come from Rose Bruford or would have come from the Central School of Speech and Drama. And the only reason what you say sort of might ring true with that is that you mentioned the use of poetry, and that was used an awful lot with voice teaching, is that they had quite a lot of the old-fashioned sort of rib reserve breathing, you know, hold your ribs out and use your belly and your diaphragm, and sort of receive pronunciation, articulation, all of that. But what they were very forward-thinking in using was a lot of poetry, so that sounds a little bit to me like you might
probably
have had
I remember my teacher saying, Nadia, vowels give emotion and consonants give meaning. I do remember learning that.
Yes.
Those are the basic things you learn when you're very small. And then you think, well, that's interesting, you know what I mean? Yes. So a few things have hung around anyway, but I did actually relearn later on in life. And of course, Ron was a singer, and I've worked a lot with singers in the last years. And of course, I was fascinated how he was taught to breathe and how he was also taught voice work, not singing work, but actually speaking voice work, and how that is the basis for singing. And although Ron had no other intention than to be a singer, he had the most beautiful speaking voice, which not always singers do.
No, I noticed that when I worked with him and when I listened to him on you know, his recordings. But I didn't know that he learnt about just the spoken voice. For some reason, I always imagined that it was the singing voice. But you say that his training is that with Hussler and Rod Marling.
Hussler and Rod Marling were the singing teachers. And when Hussler was professor in Detmold, he worked together with a voice teacher called Kohlmann. And Kohlmann was he taught actors' voice work. And in fact, he was the teacher of a colleague of mine who was professor of voice in the Folkwang for many, many years. And he was the same generation as Ron, and they both learnt with this elderly gentleman, Herr Kohlmann, and he was a coryphée about the speaking voice.
Wow. Do you know if he wrote anything, or was he just?
He might do. I'd have to look that up. Actually, I'd have to find that out.
Yeah,
I'm not sure how we would feel about it today, but I know that. As a singer, they were taught first and foremost to speak, and that the sound comes through the meaning which you are speaking.
Yeah, it's a very forward-thinking methodology. That's right. I mean, that's what a lot of voice teachers and singing teachers speak of today, and certainly I would concur. So you've graduated from your training, your ballet training, your teacher training. So what then do you then go on to do professionally, and how do you encounter the Alexander technique?
I joined an opera theatre company. In fact, I worked with two different companies over the years, and it was one of the very many German opera ballet acting companies. And I did a lot of dancing. I was also in the musical, many musicals. We were the first company to in Europe to do West Side Story. Or no, not Europe. It must have been Germany.
Right.
To do West Side Story. So I was involved in the first production in that. And so I always enjoyed singing and dancing as well as acting. And then I got some acting work in the theatre. I had to learn German for all of this, but I managed to do that. And then I moved on to another company, and I got involved with a group of musicians, and we decided to start working very experimentally with music outside the theatre. And so we created a little group called the International Chamber Music and Dance Soloists, and I did a lot of quite experimental work, working very closely to musicians. In the theatre, it always worried me a little bit that the orchestra was always accompanying the dance, and I wanted to sort of find a relationship where it was more like on equal terms. So I did that for a while, and then I decided to leave being a full-time member of a theatre, which I was for quite a few years, and to start my own school and a small company, and I moved to Hamburg. Now, I was doing an awful lot of postgraduate training as a dancer. I did a lot of a different contemporary or modern dance techniques like Martha Graham and Cunningham and José Limón. And I was also starting to get interested in mind-body disciplines like Tai Chi and yoga.
Yeah. So
that was pretty normal at the time. I also got together with visual artists, and we started moving into performance art. How is it if you actually start changing the normal dramaturgical rules of theatre? Mm-hmm. How is it if we just focus more on space and time and stillness? So this is all the fairly normal kind of experimental stuff that a woman and a movement artist of my age would have got into. And of course, like everything I do it 100%. So, now, I have not an easy body. I have a very long back, and I never had perfect turnout. So you put my passion and my strong will together with Martha Graham and quite a strong performance program, and I started developing back pain. Now, this was the absolutely best thing that could happen to me in my life, particularly when doctors couldn't help me anymore. I always say that people that don't reach the real internal truths have obviously not had enough problems. I don't mean that in any way disparagingly or anything, but I have noticed that it's through my problems and through my serious problems that I've had to delve deeper into my own self and to be more open about other people's ideas and to actually let go of some of the ideas that I'd been carrying around in my head. And, of course, my back pain was such that it stopped me dancing. And so I decided when the doctors told me I should give up dancing and teach from a chair, I decided that that wasn't going to be the life for me and I would like to find out more. And that I did. I actually did all sorts of different body awareness techniques, which are taught today in many schools. We know them, like Feldenkrais and also yoga, Tai Chi, Qigong, and other dance movement methods or these body awareness methods. I was absolutely fascinated. My mind was opening and I was having a glorious time, but I still had backache. And that's interesting. And then a friend of mine who was solo fagotist under Celi Badacher in the Munich Philharmonic, a very prolific position in a prolific orchestra, he said to me that everybody's talking about the Alexander technique in their orchestra. So you couldn't Google in those days. I got my dear father, who loved to go into libraries. I knew nothing about it. I got my dear father, who lived in Surrey and who was very good at library, looking things up in library. Anyway, he found out for me about the Alexander technique. I read a book by Michael Gelb, which I still think is actually a very good book, although I know that many Alexander people contributed to that book. It wasn't, of course, all Michael's, but he put it together very, very, very well. I read that book, and then I found out that there was a school in London run by Walter Carrington and that they gave courses for the public between Christmas and the New Year, and I went to London and did that course, and my life was changed forever.
Yeah,
that's how I got there.
So tell us a little bit about how it changed you. I mean, how did you find it, and again, what was it from that led you to decide to actually learn the technique as a teacher?
There were a couple of experiences on that first course that have never left me in the intensity and what seemed to me at that time the authenticity of the moment. And what affected me most was the tremendous freedom of movement which I experienced with about 10 times less effort. Now, if you talk about this or if you try to discuss it, it has really no meaning. But as Walter Carrington always said, if you experience that, you will never forget that moment for the rest of your life. It is so powerful. And that's why, actually, I don't discuss very much about the Alexander, because ideas can be very powerful, but they don't always lead to a powerful experience. Or ideas can seem very simple, but the experience that come out of them is undoubtedly touching on a truth and changes your life. And it was that experience with Walter Carrington that changed my life forever. Later, I had a session with Walter Carrington archery. We were out in a field and we had professional bows and arrows. And Walter came up behind me and said, "Nadia, do you want just a hand?" I was a very freshly qualified teacher in Denmark. Chris and Karen were doing some wonderful event because there were all these big events when we were training. And Walter said, "Nadia, do you want a hand?" And he put his hand on my back and another hand somewhere else. And all I remember is the arrow leaving the bow. And what did it do? Of course, it got extremely near to the bullseye. And I had no idea how it happens. No idea. I knew my intention, and I knew that theoretically what we talk about is a clear intention and then getting out of your own way. But the experience when Walter touched, and he literally just touched my back and some, I can't even remember, I don't think he even touched my neck actually. And it was the most extraordinary experience. And Walter said, "Nadia, that's the shot." And then he turned away and went and had a cup of coffee. So that was, it was one of those beautiful moments, which was like my first one, where you never forget it. You never forget it. It's one of those moments where thinking stops, all ideas stop. You have this sense where time and space, where you are actually taken out of time and space, and you are in a moment that is always now. And it's so empowering that I wanted to empower all the students that came into my hands. For me, the Alexander is the most empowering method I have ever experienced. It gives people individuality. It gives them a sense of themselves, and it gives them psychophysical clarity and strength I have not really experienced in any other method. So I knew this was going to change my dance pedagogic. It was going to change my performance work, and I went on to train.
That's fascinating, and I totally. I mean, having been a student of the technique for about 17 years, I can completely concur with what you're saying there. And that's beautifully expressed. So why did you not train in London? Why did you go to Denmark to train?
I was living in Hamburg at the time, and I had a family. And after I had this experience at Walter Carrington's, there was a teacher on that course, at Walter Carrington's course, and he looked quite eccentric, and he suddenly walked in with a skeleton called Frederick and gave us the most wonderful anatomy lesson. I mean, I'd learned a bit of anatomy and this and that, but suddenly this wild wonderfully warm-hearted man giving a lecture with Frederick. And that was another moment. I found out later that this man, who actually I married later, that was Chris Stevens. I found out that this man was actually a physicist, and he was also a yoga teacher and an Alexander teacher. And again, I felt the way he described anatomy and what we're actually affecting when we apply the processes we learn in the Alexander method, it was to do with connecting ourselves up with actually cosmic forces and very, very down-to-earth cosmic forces. And that, again, fascinated me. I wanted to get behind everything. I wanted to get to the truth of movement and expression and everything. So I asked Chris whether he would come to my dance studio in Hamburg, and I promised him full workshops. Would he come and teach the Alexander? And he came and taught for several years. And then he opened up a training course with Karen Wentworth in Denmark, and I signed on. And I was able to connect that also with my family life, because it's not that far. It was actually nearer and easier for me.
So can you remember, again, roughly what years this would have been, when you trained?
I started in 1984 to train in Denmark, and I qualified in 1987. That's the classical 3-year training.
Yeah, and again, it's just useful for people who are not that familiar with the technique, why it takes 3 years, because a lot of these things these days, aren't we, where, people do, a 6-week Pilates course and they're off training it, training people in it. And so it's just interesting, I think, for people who are not that familiar with the technique or how teachers are trained, why it's classically 3 years.
It takes 3 years. And I even encourage people to take longer if they need that time. I think 5 years is also perfectly all right if it accompanies your profession as an actor or a dancer or what other people want to do. I think 5 years is absolutely fine. If you are in the business of getting behind habit, which we are dealing with in the Alexander work, and reaching the essence of your potential and allowing your potential to be expressed through your profession and not only your habits, that's going to take quite a long time. On top of it, you then have to learn the skills to teach somebody else that, while you don't reverse back to your own habit, because you're wanting to be a good teacher. Usually our habits in some way involve effort because we want to be good at something. And if we want to be a good teacher, even though you've learned how to get behind your habits, you tend to revert to your habits because you're hoping that this pupil's going to come back and help you pay your rent or whatever. So I actually think that 3 years is not too long at all. We've, of course, become a lot more skilled in communicating the processes involved in becoming an Alexander Technique teacher. And I don't think you have to be there every day for 3 years, in no way. I actually encourage people to keep their professions, and I've become very adaptable to work around that. So people are immediately able to apply what they're learning when we're talking about becoming an Alexander teacher in their own professions. And it works brilliantly. But I don't think under 3 years that anybody can really, and I'm going to use a word that some people might discuss, what does this actually mean? I don't think people can embody the Alexander processes unless they've had the very classical timeline of 3 years. And that is what it is the first year you're opening up all sorts of new things and you're utterly delighted and you found sort of the new Bible and everything. And then the second year, you're confronted with yourself. So you're not quite sure whether this Bible is so interesting after all, or maybe there are some other things that I need because this thing called self is very painful and maybe it doesn't work. And then suddenly when you move into the third year, you suddenly start discovering, actually, this is all possible and I can integrate that into an expanded and heightened awareness of myself. And the amazing thing in about this third year, what I notice about training teachers, is that their minds open up. On one side, they become more integrated, more clear in themselves. And in another way, their minds are opening up to include other kinds of social, political, artistic ideas. But they do that without losing their centers. And then I feel my job maybe is done. We can let them go wild out in the world. I hope that answered your question.
No, totally. No, thank you very much for that. And how was the training for you? Did it mirror what you just discussed then? Was it what you expected it to be, wanted it to be, or was it unexpected? What do you remember from your training days as an Alexander teacher?
I absolutely adored my training. I think I adored every single day of my training. My training was an experimental training. They set it up just for 3 years to train a very large group. We were about 28 people. We were a huge group and we had huge numbers of guest teachers from all over the place. And so we had our regular teachers and we had all these guest teachers. So from the very beginning, I had a wonderful time. We were doing sport and running. We were playing the cello. We were dancing. We were acting. We were doing science. We were doing pedagogy and sociology, a philosophy. I was just having the most wonderful time. I think towards the end of my training, Chris Stevens, who I became friends with, Chris Stevens started asking some basic questions about the science behind the Alexander. And then I started realizing there was an awful lot I still had to learn. I'm not saying in any way it's because my training course didn't provide it. It's because basically a training course can only offer a certain amount of input. And then every teacher has to go off and find that themselves. But because I was a very ambitious dancer, I did have a lot of physical interferences in my psychophysical system, and I hadn't really calmed myself down enough. But that was fine. I had so much good input that I was able, after my training and in with working together with Chris Stevens, I was very able to continue my learning process and become a lot more aware of what's really going on and where we want to move towards.
No, thank you. Thank you. And what was your, so that sort of leads us quite nicely actually into your journey after the training and what you then sort of continued to do in your exploration of the technique along with Chris. And So after you left training, what was your journey then? What did you keep dancing as well? What did you have those sort of two things going? What happened?
The Alexander work changed my approach to training, to dancing, to teaching dancers and teaching actors fundamentally. And of course, if you've left one bank of the river, you've got to put up with floating around in the middle of the river a bit before you get to the other side of the river. And so, I mean, that's normal for any artist anyway. You're used to that kind of, okay, that doesn't satisfy my artistic questioning. I've got to float around a bit. So I was continuing dancing, but I wasn't really happy with what was going on. Yeah. I needed to be more radical about the changes. So it wasn't just like carrying on the same, but just making sure, you know, my neck is free or my back is lengthening or my knee. It required a much more radical change in my whole understanding of what I'm doing. And so shortly after I qualified, Chris Stevens and I got together and he moved to Hamburg and we started a training course. So we were able within the training course to really look in to a lot of mechanisms and principles behind the way that we were moving towards teaching, which Chris called the support system and I later called the psychophysical support system. Chris got interested in what are the scientific mechanisms behind the technique. Some Alexander teachers we experienced used to talk about a mystery and just do what we're saying and everything will be fine. But of course, if you're a scientist, you have a curiosity that wants to know what's really going on. Mm. So he did some scientific research and got some interesting results. It was connected with his scientific research and also his human common sense, I think, and his interest in sport, that he started discovering mechanisms going on that weren't explicitly named in a normal Alexander training. Although people all over the world, I mean, it's a bit like the monkeys, isn't it, that started washing their potatoes all at the same time all over the world, you know, collective subconscious and everything. A lot of people throughout the world have come to similar understanding or have come to similar answers to normal human needs. I just think Chris did it extremely, as they say in Germany, consequently. He was so consequent about it and not just mentioning these things, but actually systematically putting it together. So our Alexander pupils and students had a real systematic method by which they could improve how they use themselves and also the use of their pupils. So the first couple of years after I qualified, I actually had a full practice from the day I finished. I had dancers, actors, musicians, singers, people with back pain, curious friends, therapists, philosophers, composers. I just had the most wonderful practice in Hamburg. And Chris and I had the great opportunity to actually use all the information we were getting from our pupils to start developing how we wanted to teach this long term and how we want to train teachers.
So whilst Chris was sort of doing the science sort of research, investigating into that, how were you working with him on that? I mean, were you also working on the science? Were you looking at other aspects of research? What were your areas?
Well, yeah, it's a very good question, actually, because I always felt as an Alexander teacher a total failure because although people kept coming back. So then I thought, oh, okay. I felt a failure because I was taught to inhibit. Now, in the Alexander work, inhibition is one of the central processes as a tool for change. And this process called inhibition, of course, is a process of the central nervous system. But in the Alexander work, what we do in such a in such an enjoyable way is that we bring processes that are actually unconscious onto a conscious level. And inhibition, as you well know, Alex, is the activity of giving yourself time before you begin to do something. Inhibition actually has many, many aspects to it, and our current researchers, both in England and Europe and in the States, are being able to define a lot more what inhibition could be. But I was never very good at giving myself that much time because I was so impassioned about dancing and performing. And I watched some of my Alexander colleagues, and they always seemed so much quieter and softer than I was. And I was still jumping around and just sort of needing to express vital and passionate and deep emotional or whatever states. So I thought that I had a lot to learn. So I thought, okay, Nadia, how about if you start studying some of the dances of non-European people? So I got actually really interested in some of those wild shamanistic dances and many of the kind of African dances that I could get hold of. I was particularly interested in several groups of Africans. I don't want to mention them here because that's another issue, but they absolutely fascinated me. And I spent a lot of time studying all the material I could get. And I would bring that back to Chris, and he would look into possible scientific mechanisms behind it. And the one thing that was most obvious is that if you truly get out of your way, you can be wild and impassioned, and you don't just have to be a quiet performer. Helped me along my way, and it helped me a great deal when I started to take my work into professional theatres, that it is a matter of choice how you use the work. And it actually, the work doesn't determine the form in itself. All it does is give you more choice. And you can decide to be zenny and calm, or you can be decide to be wild and shamanistic, or you can be decide to be powerful and earthy. It's a matter of artistic or psychological or spiritual choice. The most important thing is that we get ourselves free of the habit which might limit us. Now, habit is always based on fear, like what we see in the world at the moment with all the problems caused by Corona. A lot of very extreme political stances or political groups are being built up. And some of them, of course, have some extremely important things to say. And some of it, you understand, is built or is almost like a projection of internal fear that's building up over the months, over the insecurities, over the control, over the fears of having no perspective in the future. And then you understand how sometimes quite extreme ideas get developed, but actually they're expressing a lack of internal orientation. And so I've always tried to use the Alexander work as a form of internal orientation so people's minds stay free.
I think it's very useful hearing you talking about this because actually we did in a previous podcast talk about inhibition, and we talked about this very same idea of about opening up choices. But why I particularly wanted to talk to you and the I mentioned in my email to you was your use of language, the way you talk about this and talk about the technique, is because I think sometimes and of course, this is coming in the context of what's happening in drama schools, conservatoire drama schools in England at the moment, is sometimes the technique is looked upon or seen from the outside as being something that is absolutely what you were saying, being equated with this stillness and this sort of, perfect alignment or whatever you want to call it. And what I like about the way you're talking about this is that actually, of course, that's a choice that you can go with, but also it also enables you to play those characters or go to those places with characters or dance or whatever it might be that you're doing. That can be very full on or frenetic or highly emotional. And I think sometimes it's seen as being an adjunct to training or something dispensable with training, because it is just viewed as being something that gets the student very quiet and still and well aligned. And that's not what you're saying at all, is it?
No, the thing is that you have to begin by quietening people down, because if a person's nervous system is activated or agitated, there is absolutely no chance of making change. There's no chance, because a nervous system that's agitated is always going to use the part of the brain that chooses the known and what seems to them to be the most safe thing. Mm-hmm. So you have to calm people's nervous systems down, and you have to calm their nervous systems down so much that the person inside begins to experience an enormous desire to be free and to express themselves. And once you've actually calmed the nervous system down and you have provided your system, when I say it's your system, your psychophysical system, with the basic information it needs in order to get behind a habit and to align with much greater natural forces than those pupils would ever imagine they have within them, once you actually get them aligned with it, you can start to encourage them to open up more, to get more free, to get more authentic, and you will find that they are able to develop forms of expression that they had never believed possible.
It's very encouraging hearing you say that, because again, it sounds to me like what you're saying is it's really ultimately about developing potential. It's about opening up somebody's potential in a, like you say, an exciting and sometimes unfamiliar way, which is also exciting, that opens up avenues of creativity they didn't know they had in them. And again, I think this is so important because, again, I think we're entering into a very interesting time in actor training where a lot of these techniques are being called into question. They're being sort of accused of imposing something on people and making people conform to a pattern or whether it be a certain pattern of acting or a pattern of physical use or a pattern of vocal use. And I think what all of us know who've been in training actors for a long time, all of us know when we're talking about it, is that what we all hope we're doing is developing people's potential. We're opening up, we're giving them choices in life as opposed to just restricting them. And again, it sounds like that's what you're saying with that.
Yeah, absolutely, Alex, absolutely. The thing is, along the road to accessing potential, we can get some funny ideas about ourselves. I've noticed that within most performing artists is a kind of secret desire to be right and a secret belief that if I was right, then I would get a job.
Yes.
Now, that's one of the biggest illusions we have to very kindly free our people from. Because if you start doing Alexander lessons with an internal need to be right and then feel, if I get the Alexander technique really right, then I'm going to be this perfect human being with no more problems and everything. So it's nothing to do with the Alexander work that's not right. It's the attitude which the person hasn't yet been freed of, if you get me. Now, that can apply to any method or any technique.
Yeah.
Now, if you're doing performing art, performing artists have got to get access to the part of their soul which takes them into chaos, which takes them through chaos, which takes them into language, may it be the voice or physical or whatever, which is at that moment created. Now, you're not going to do that if you're trying to be the perfect person. You are just not going to do that. To try to be perfect and try to be right is the conditioning which actually the Alexander method should be taking people away from. But we have many dear souls in this world that don't want to give that belief up about being perfect and right. And so they're going to use anything in order to strengthen that process, if you get me.
Well, I do, because I remember very distinctly the last time. So I'm just going to turn the light on. Hang on, I can just quickly turn the light on. Yes, no, absolutely. I remember you saying to me the last time we spoke, it's something that was very interesting that you've sort of actually gone into, actually, was you said to me, make the Alexander technique work for you rather than you work for it. And I thought that was very interesting. It came out of a discussion we were having, I don't know if you remember, about breathing, actually.
I do remember it well.
Yeah. I was saying, I think I was sort of approaching an issue that I was finding working with a student from a very sort of, you know, I've got to do this and I've got to do that and I mustn't do this and I mustn't do that. I remember you just saying, you know, that you need to work on the issue first and then work out how you got there. So solve it first and then work out how you got to it afterwards, which was very interesting, I thought. And then the second thing you said to me was make the Alexander technique work for you rather than you it. And that thing that you were talking about getting things right, which certainly a lot of students, if there's any students who will be listening, will completely get. In fact, I was working with some today who were recognizing this in themselves. But also as a teacher, I recognize it in myself, exactly what you were saying about being an Alexander teacher. You know, certainly, you know, I think it's easy to use any of this as a sort of a rod to beat yourself with, isn't it? As a sort of like, you know, oh God, I've got to be doing this. I've got to be doing that. Am I thinking about this? Am I thinking about that? Oh my God, my use is just terrible today. Rather than as something that can facilitate freedom in any given moment or open up creative possibilities. And this idea of it opening something up creatively rather than it just being a sort of form of body work. This is what I'm very interested in with your particular research that you've done, is how this isn't just body mechanics. This isn't just, you know, standing in the right position. This is, you know, like you say, it's psychophysical.
This is one of the biggest risks we can take, to actually let go of all the packaging we put around ourselves in order to feel great. To actually let go of that and be raw. And the Alexander has the potential to do that. Be raw in the sense that anything could happen now. I've found that the actors and dancers I've worked with have responded 10 times as creatively to all the input from directors and choreographers if we have trained in this way beforehand. So for me, there's no question about it. It is a liberator, and it's not about standing perfectly.
And I wondered if you could speak a bit for people listening about what the psychophysical support system is, because obviously I've experienced it in the hands of teachers, and I use it in a hands-off way in my own practice as a voice teacher. But for those people listening, it's a very unique approach to the Alexander technique, isn't it? And certainly it's something in the UK, I think it's probably we're not as familiar with as perhaps in the Netherlands. But do you mind sort of talking a little bit about what the psychophysical support system is?
Yes. Of course, before something is born, there are years of questions being posed and lives led living into the answers. So when I describe it, it might come out slightly simplistic.
That's fine.
But Chris and I were asking some quite fundamental questions. One of the questions we asked was, can you really free yourself from yourself if you mentally begin by sending a message to your neck? Now, I know as an Alexander teacher that the freedom of the neck is absolutely essential if we are going to get some kind of elastic force released in the body, if the spine is going to work to its full potential, if the breathing mechanism is going to be freed up and trained and coordinate with the voice, and all of that coordinate with the four limbs. We know the neck needs to be free in order that that can happen. But Chris and I asked, is that the first thing that we should be doing? Never questioned the necessity of it, but we questioned the timing of it. And then we did some research, Chris did some research and found out, and I'm cutting a huge long story short,
sure,
that the coordination of the body was more interfered with if the feet had been put in ice water than if the neck had been stiffened by boards on the outside.
Gotcha. Wow.
Now that was, and Chris was actually, when he coordinated this research being done, when he found that out, he was hugely disappointed, because actually he thought he was going to prove that the neck was the first and only thing, but it didn't prove it. Now that shows a really good piece of scientific research. If in fact the result of your research actually is negative to what you expected. So usually it shows that you've done your job well. So anyway, we started getting interested in the feet. And that's when I started researching into where does the initial physical power come from when I watch those people that didn't grow up in a Western male-dominated European society.
Yeah.
And where performing had something to do with connecting to the world around them and cosmos, and not just standing on a stage and what's it called? You know, whatever it was.
Yeah.
So we started getting interested in the feet.
Yeah.
And then Chris discovered that there are, this wasn't Chris's research. It was his wonderful ability to talk to top scientists. I would put it that way.
Mm.
But of course, there are in the feet sensors that are actually sending messages to our nervous system, which are connected to the postural system of the body. So we started working with the feet before we worked with the neck. And to get people really feeling the planet Earth underneath them before they actually do anything else. Now, because Chris was a physicist, he knew it wasn't just about feeling planet Earth, and actors love to feel and all that business. It was more than that. And this is where the Alexander work so comes into it. And it takes something where loads of movement teachers will say, yeah, but we all get our pupils to feel the ground and use the ground and everything. Yeah, but what is their real intention? Now, this was Chris then, as a physicist, came in here and said, are we actually really understanding what's going on? So gravity is actually pulling us towards the planet Earth. Planet Earth is actually coming towards us. And there is a force which is created in that place of contact, which is the soles of the feet. We call that a contact force or resistance force. And this force will want to go back in the opposite direction of gravity. Now, if you're standing, that's really useful because it's going up. Now, once you start understanding, you can't fight against gravity. Otherwise, you are not going to benefit from the gift that planet Earth is giving us. And that is contact force, which is going to go up in the opposite direction. Now, that is the basis of it all. We continue to have a look at it and discover, okay, contact force or resistance force can only actually be effective in a structure if there is enough resistance in that structure to pass this upthrust on from where it begins to where the physical being actually ends. Of course, we very soon understood that muscles are not going to do that job because muscles, if you give them an upthrust, are going to buckle. And so there must be something in the body that can actually use this upthrust in an enormously creative way and open the body up. And of course, we just happen to have the perfect mechanism for that. It's our bones. Now, the wonderful thing about the bones are is that they have a certain rigidity, which gives us an erectness, but the bones meet in places that give us all our movement possibilities. Now, we discovered that if you use the bones in this way, the body actually gets a lot more stable through the upthrust, and that sends a message to all the structures around the joints and say, you haven't got to worry about this guy, Alex. He's not going to fall over now. He's really well supported. And what actually happens is the muscles and the active structures around the joints start to release because they haven't got to save Alex's life. And suddenly the joints get freer. So we discovered that through this internal support system, that the body gets a lot more stable, and at the same time, the joints get freer. Now, in my work as professor at my University of Arts in Essen in Germany, I trained a lot of dancers in this way. Now, interestingly enough, I was at a teacher's meeting of the dance department a few months ago. It must have been before Corona. In the meantime, the dancers that I trained at the university have now returned and have full-time positions, or some of them are full-time and some of them are part-time positions in the dance department. And we were talking about this and that, and they suddenly told me that when they learnt this work, that they had this incredible sense of integrity within their bodies, of being connected up, which made them feel so much more courageous to dance freely.
Wow. Now,
I only heard that a year ago after they qualified. I mean, I trained these kids about 25 years ago. Now they're wonderful young artists and adults teaching themselves. And they just gave me feedback that it gave them the courage to be freer. They felt so much more what we call integrated within themselves. Now, these were dancers, so we weren't actually at this moment talking about the voice or the breathing. It was talking about their dance expression. But there you go. That's the story of the feet and the bones and the support system.
That's amazing. Thank you so much. And I just think it's good to know, you know, that just to hear again how that process has enabled those young artists to feel more creative, more courageous, more dynamic. And these are dancers. These are people who are moving all the time. You know, that's their job. Even more so than actors. And I think, again, this is something really good to hear. So so how then do you, how do you, obviously, maybe you can talk a little bit about your job at Folk Wang and just a little bit more about that, how you got into that, how you sort of, how you found your way into there, and then how you went about teaching this process to groups as well as individuals, because the Alexander technique is always known as quite classically as always being one-on-one, and this is a situation where you're teaching groups. So it'd be very interesting, I think, for people to hear sort of A, how you sort of got into that, and B, how you then taught this psychophysical support system to young artists in a big setting.
Thank you for inviting me to talk about it. I'll just take one step back before I go forward. Recognizing the importance of the neck to be free and of the coordination of the back or the head with the back and the spine, we noticed that if our pupils and students first of all worked on their support system from the ground and from the bones, something amazing happened. Their necks spontaneously released. Now, I had been spending years of my life talking to my neck nonstop, almost like a mantra. And in the moment I sort of, you know, jumped off the train, I had to start all over again because my neck's different. And I suddenly noticed, and we noticed, that the neck actually provides us with information if there is some kind of interference in the whole body. And you have to find out where that interference is. The amazing thing is that we found out that everybody interferes with their feet and legs. Everybody interferes with their feet, their legs, and their pelvis. And so, if you just talk to your neck, you are not actually going to get to some underlying problems. And that's why we put the support system before time, the time-wise, in the order of things, before we started working on what is classically known in the Alexander work, the primary control, which I still teach in all aspects, as I learned from my teachers and from Walter and from Alexander's books. Now, this was very interesting because I started starting to think, if this support system is basically so logical and is so connected with our own experience of being on planet Earth and connecting to our internal support system via our skeletons, And then the neck will actually free off spontaneously. Mm. Maybe it's possible to teach this in a group.
Yeah, yeah.
Because what it means is to actually communicate to the students the mechanisms behind it all, but not in a dry way. You have to speak to people so that their imaginations and their souls and their psyches and their fears and their needs get spoken about or spoken to.
Mm.
Every single actor and performer needs to feel a certain amount of security to go out on stage, even if they pretend they'll deal without it.
Yeah.
And so we started to experience that an actor or a dancer who actually connects themselves up psychophysically, I say psychophysically, to the ground underneath them that's supporting them, has a very different set of conditions to be free. Because as all the wisdom teachers tell us, stability will always come before freedom. And freedom will always be limited if stability is not taken care of. And so I took it upon myself to actually teach in that order. First of all, to give students a sense of arriving and stability, both from outside and from inside, and then to start encouraging them to release and to open up. Now, because this is all based on physiology and physics, I was able to describe the process. Because myself, I'm a very emotional woman, and I could never imagine leaving my feelings out of any picture. And interestingly enough, I've discovered the wonderful scientists I've actually worked with in any way are also deeply feeling people, and people with a beautiful imagination, and they love to sing and they love to do this and do that. And they're extremely sensitive people. So I felt at home owning up to all of that. Of course, as a performer, you have to have it. So I started developing a way to describe this support system in a way that it touches people's minds, their hearts, their souls, and their emotional needs. And suddenly I discovered that I increased the empowerment of the students threefold, if not tenfold.
Yeah.
When I started developing this work, I read in a newspaper that a new professorship was created in the Folkwang University of Arts. It was, I think, the first in Germany. It was an interdisciplinary professorship for body awareness. And, you know, when you write out a professorship, I've done dozens and dozens and dozens of these things myself in the meantime. You have to write in the advertisement what you want your people to be able to do.
Yeah.
And they wrote in this, they wrote slapstick, mask work, speaking, breathing, singing, I don't know, this and that, and the Alexander technique. There it was in the advertisement in this national newspaper.
Right.
So I applied for it and told them, actually, I've done all of those things. Aikido, you know, everything that you sort of need. I've actually done all of those things and I love it all, but I actually professionally am also an Alexander teacher. So I was invited among lots of other people to go and audition, and I was given tenure. I was given the professorship, and after a year I was given tenure. And so I could actually go into my university and take my time to do some root changes, to do structures at the very root of academic artistic training, and to introduce body awareness as a subject available to every single student training at our art school.
Wow.
So, and it took a long time because, of course, there were a lot of people saying that this is not necessary anymore, or this is not what we want. And
really?
A little bit, Yeah, there were a lot of people. I mean, I'm saying there were a lot of people. I mean, there were a lot of people who wanted it.
Yes.
I had to do enormous pioneer work in the first, apart from the, you know, I was one of the first women professors. I was young and at that time very pretty, so people tell me. So I was actually classed in a different category than actually what the professorship was intending to do. So I just had to deal with these challenges. Sometimes I did it well and sometimes I failed, but I didn't give up.
Good.
Because I believe, and now, of course, I have unconditional support from all of my colleagues and from the head of the school. It's quite extraordinary how our school now stands behind having body awareness as a subject, not only for artistic excellence, but also as a contribution to health and psychophysical balance and resilience within our students. So I'm very lucky now that a time I'm going to leave, I have great confidence that our university is enlightened and know if they don't take care of students, we are going to get problems, or the students will get problems as young performers when their bodies and minds are not able to deal with the pressure which increases and not decreases. So I got this job and I started, and I had so many students, I couldn't possibly give them all individual work. And so I started trying out giving group lessons. And I developed my language and my vocabulary and my ability to communicate to the students, and it worked. It really, really worked. And then what I did is I took students out if I feel they have a particular need, or they had a particularly difficult role to play or whatever, and I took them out and gave them individual lessons. Now, in the meantime, the Alexander technique is actually in the examining, the exams. They all do Alexander. They have to have Alexander. And it has proved to be exceptionally useful for all the performing arts and for the musicians. Because I'm the head of the body awareness department, I also invite colleagues who are also artists with some kind of body awareness method. I like Feldenkrais or Pilates or some performance studies or Tai Chi. I invite them also to give courses. So our students can have a wide range of stuff.
Yes.
And they can get their credit points for all of this stuff. But in the performing arts department, the Alexander technique is now anchored. And I'm very grateful about that.
Yeah, that's wonderful. And I think, you've actually sort of said this in wonderfully in many different ways actually today. But I think sometimes what schools over here are doing, and it sounds what you're doing rather wonderfully, is you're keeping the core of what you're doing, but you also allow students to explore other methodologies as well. So it's not this sort of closed shop. But I think what maybe people who don't have the experience or the knowledge about the technique look at the Alexander technique in some of the drama schools. I think this is what is happening, and they're going, well, what, you know, we can just give them Tai Chi, we can just give them Feldenkrais, we can just give them yoga, you know. It's body work, it's mind body, it's, you know, which of course, you know, I'm not saying it's not. And I just wondered, as you sort of had said this, so I don't want to sort of like push it any further if you don't feel there is anything that you haven't really said about it, but and you may well have done when I listen back over this, but what do you think is it that makes it, you found it with yourself in that all those other practices, while being very useful and helpful and interesting, didn't solve the back problem. But what do you think it is that makes it unique in an actor or in a performing artist training that is just perhaps unique and perhaps makes it not just something you can just sort of kick out and replace with any other sort of body work or body practice or mind-body practice?
Of course, because I encourage all performing artists to experience Alexander work, I am convinced of its uniqueness. I should try to describe a few of the aspects of the Alexander which I think are unique.
Mm.
I understand when people not familiar with body awareness techniques, I understand that they cannot see, or it's hard to imagine what this actually means. So I'll try to describe it in a very simple language. The first thing about the Alexander, which I find absolutely fascinating, is it's what you do before you do something. It's not a workout. There is no form to it. Even though we use standing and sitting and walking, it's actually formless. And because it's formless, and because it's what you do before you do something, it's got nothing to do with most of the other body awareness methods that have a kind of workout, whatever it is. Now, what does it mean when you say the Alexander technique is what you do before you do something? And of course, when we ask that question, we have to mention the two central processes which are involved in the Alexander work, which I have seen in the purity and the consequence in no other method. And these two processes, of course, are inhibition and direction. And inhibition is actually telling you to stop doing something. And inhibition and direction is actually teaching you the power of intention and thought and communication. Now, neither of those really are a physical workout. But the huge difference between Alexander technique and sort of awareness techniques or mindfulness is that these processes are utterly inseparable from physical processes. You can only practice inhibition and direction if you have the intention of a physical activity. Otherwise, you can't practice it. You have to have the deep desire of some kind of physical activity in order to practice inhibition and direction. The more passionately you want to do something, the more of a master you can become in inhibition and direction. If you don't particularly want to do anything, you cannot practice the Alexander technique. It's impossible.
That's a very interesting way of putting that. I don't think I've ever heard the technique talked about in that way. And I think that's completely the opposite in probably most people's minds when they first hear about the Alexander technique, that you've actually got to have a strong passion to do something. And of course, that's what Alexander had, didn't he? He had a strong passion to act.
Now, the thing is with the Alexander work is what our teachers are teaching the young actors and the young dancers or musicians, whoever we're talking about, they're not teaching them a movement method. They're not teaching them to stand up straight. No. They are actually teaching them how they can use their bodies in what whatever activity they're involved in.
Yeah.
In order to be most efficient about how much energy they use,
yeah,
and to get the highest level of force, energy, and coordination out of themselves.
Yes. Yeah.
That's what we're teaching them to do. And this is surely got to be both a physical, a mental, and what I call a psychical thing. Because there are processes within the body that aren't necessarily mental. There are internal movements of sensation, of emotion, of intuition, which are not necessarily mental processes, but these have all got to be coordinated. They've all got to be brought into one channel in order to direct it into whatever we are performing. And the Alexander work will give us a method where we can use our awareness, our perception all the time to actually strengthen those abilities to connect our mind, our body, our psychical abilities, our emotions, our feelings, our sensation, and most of all, our perceptions. We've got to be able to coordinate those all up. And I have had experience of no other method that does it so brilliantly as this one.